Welcome back to Current State. We hope your long weekend was therapeutic, more or less. The Thanksgiving weekend can be an odd combination of stress and relaxation. And it got a little iffy toward the end for me at the Auburn-Alabama game on Saturday. Got dangerously agitated there. Feeling nice and mellow, and then the end of the game rolled along with millions of other football fans, got pretty worked up there as Auburn, watching Auburn pull out a win in the Iron Bowl, a finish for the ages there. But we're glad you're back. It's Monday on today's Current State. A nascent fashion design sector is looming for downtown Lansing. Learn about the runway coming up in the program. And Al Martin of WKAR's Current Sports joins us to look ahead to Saturday and beyond Saturday for the MSU Spartan football team, of course, in the Big Ten Championship in Indianapolis. At the top of our program today, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments today in a Michigan case with potential repercussions for other states as well. It involves Indian tribal rights and casino operations. For 3 years, Michigan's Bay Mills tribe has been in a legal battle with the state over its casino north of Gaylord. A decision last year by the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the legality of the establishment, but it triggered an appeal by Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette. Now, in the case to be heard by the nation's highest court, the Bay Mills tribe says it's entitled to sovereign immunity from lawsuits filed by the state. Now, the high court's decision, which is expected next year, will likely impact the continued expansion of casino gambling in many states, including Michigan, either by restricting or expanding where casinos may be built. The Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta is in Washington for today's arguments. I spoke with him earlier this morning and asked him for more background on how the two sides got to this point.
Well, about 3 years ago, the Bay Mills tribe decided that they were going to try and open a casino in Vanderbilt in northern Michigan. It's a small town. It's about 100 miles south of their reservation in the Upper Peninsula. And what they're doing is kind of testing the legal waters for an off-reservation casino. And if they do, they can open more. And the reason they want to do this is because there aren't a lot of people in the eastern Upper Peninsula, but there are a lot of casinos. So that market is kind of saturated. So they're looking for new places to go to.
What exactly will the high court be deciding? What's the question that's in front of them?
The narrow point that it seems that the court will be deciding on is whether or not there's essentially a loophole in the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act that basically allows an Indian tribe like Bay Mills to open a casino off a reservation with money that it's bought for the purpose of buying tribal land. But since Congress made no specific provisions for the tribes which have what's called sovereign immunity to be sued in cases like this, the tribes say that means you just can't sue us. We can buy land, we can open a casino, and really there's nothing in federal court that you can do about this.
And what would be the implications of the court finding in the state of Michigan's favor in this?
Well, it depends. If it does find in the state's favor, it depends on how far it finds in the state's favor. Hmm. What has a lot of tribes concerned, because you know tribes all across the country are watching this as are states, is that Michigan is saying once you step off the reservation, tribes, you no longer enjoy that sovereign immunity, that immunity that units of government have from lawsuits. And that means if you do something, then we can sue you. We can sue you in federal court. We can go after assets that you have. You're just another property owner like any other property owner in the state. And if the court goes that far, what that means for the tribes is that, I mean, they're not just another property owner, that they're actually a unit of government that derives its revenue from running businesses and to put your businesses where you can make some money, you've really got to go off the reservation. They don't have the they don't have a lot of taxing authorities. The tribe don't, and there's really not a lot of value to tax on a reservation anyway. And so without this immunity that they can negotiate, without this immunity, and they're saying we can't go off the reservation, we can't open up these businesses, not just casinos, that you know, there's a water park in Mount Pleasant that they even own, you know, dry cleaning services, things like that, that all of those are endangered, and we've got to rethink our participation in the larger economy, which then begs the question of, well, then how are these tribal governments going to get the revenue to run schools, provide social services, do tribal police and fire protection, things like that?
Mm. And finding in the tribe's favor, what would be the implications there?
Well, I mean, one of the implications is that as long as you can go and buy up some, you know, some property and do it in the right way, that you don't really have to stay on a reservation to get a casino. Now, you know, you do still have to get, you know, the approval of the Federal Department of Interior. That, for example, that's, you know, happening in Lansing right now, that the Sioux tribe, the Sioux St. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians, would like to open a casino in Lansing, mm-hmm. that they've got an option on a plot of land there. But instead of, you know, sort of opening a casino and then saying, now you try to make it go away, they are asking the Federal Department of Interior to declare that land is held in trust as tribal land so they can put a casino on it. So they're taking a different avenue.
So finding in the tribe's favor, would that likely accelerate casino expansion in Michigan?
Potentially it could, certainly.
There appear to be different interpretations of what exactly the tribe's contract with the state is. Is that going to become clearer after the Supreme Court's decision is announced?
That's not really a play in this case, because what Bay Mills is saying is this is outside the four corners of the compact of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. What they're saying is the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act deals with on-reservation casinos, but we're trying to open a casino off of a reservation. It's still tribal land, but it's not a government-recognized reservation. It's a complex and nuanced argument.
Mm. Could the decision have an impact on matters beyond casino expansion?
Well, yeah, as I pointed out, that you know, tribes operate all kinds of businesses that are off of the reservations in order to, you know, make money and derive revenue for tribal operations. All of those businesses are, you know, potentially in play in one way or another. That if tribes, you know, I spoke with Matthew Fletcher, who is a professor at the Indigenous Law Center there at MSU, and he said that, you know, what this means is that any of these businesses, if something goes awry without that immunity, without that sovereign immunity, I mean, all kinds of trust funds for children's services, for taking care of the elderly, for buying land, would potentially be at risk in the case of a lawsuit. And so then you've got to decide as a tribe whether or not it's worth it to go off, to go open a business off reservation.
And I understand other states are watching this very closely. This very same dynamic is unfolding in a number of states.
Well, it's just this question of sovereign immunity and states' relationships with Indian tribes on off-reservation activities. This doesn't really seem to have a lot of effect on sovereign immunity on the reservation. But, I mean, this could change states' relationships with the tribes. 17 states have filed what are called amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs in this case, and 60-something tribes in the American Congress of Indian Tribes have all filed briefs in this case as well.
The Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta, who's covering today's oral arguments between the state of Michigan and the Bay Mills Indian Tribe at the U.S. Supreme Court. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The business startup scene here in Lansing is about to get another boost. A business incubator for fashion designers called The Runway is expected to open in February in the historic former Knapp's department store building downtown. The project will house up to 12 designers in residence and a retail store and will work to retain and cultivate design talent here in mid-Michigan. With me now to tell us more about The Runway is Jeff Henry, the incubator's operations manager. Hi, Jeff.
How's it going, Mark?
Welcome to Current State. And joining him is Lansing fashion designer Rebecca Clark, who has her own label called Tribe. That's with a Y, T-R-Y-B-E. I love that. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you.
This sounds so interesting, what you have cooking downtown. Tell us how The Runway will work, Jeff.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having us. And on behalf of the LEDC and Lansing Economic Area Partnership, we're excited to bring this project to Lansing. The possibilities of what this has to offer are pretty robust, and we're just excited to be able to take the fashion industry as a whole and give it a boost here in Michigan. And that's what The Runway is all about, is building a foundation for designers to come in, learn how to get their brand off the ground from a business standpoint, and then also get the resources behind them to do the production side, and then taking that product to market.
Tell us about your physical location, though, here. How much room do you have to work with?
Oh, absolutely. We have a beautiful space. It's about 6,800 square feet altogether. It's two stories. We're actually on the Washtenaw side of the Knapp's building. And the first level will be the retail space, which will be featuring all Michigan-based designers. Kind of a high-end boutique feel. It's going to be a really great shopping experience for people in the Lansing area to come and get a taste of, you know, what Michigan designers are up to. And there's a lot of talent out there. Rebecca's collection and brand Tribe being one of them. And we're excited to showcase that. And then on the second level, we will have the fashion incubator itself, which will have a large shared workspace with all the software, technology, and equipment that they would need to produce a sample collection to take to market, and then they'll have their private studio space as well where they can conduct, you know, meetings and things of that nature, meet with clients.
How many designers will you have room for?
We have 12 private studio spaces, and we're calling those our designers in residence. So we have room for 12. And then we also are going to be setting up an associate designer program, which in the incubator world is kind of like a virtual tenancy where someone can pay a small monthly fee and be able to have access to some of the equipment and some consulting resources and things of that nature, but not actually have to have studio space. So we're looking to maybe try to get another 8 to 10 through that as well.
Okay. Rebecca, you and I have crossed paths before. You were involved in a story that I did here on WKAR last year. Tell our listeners again a little bit more about your background, because you have a pretty rich history in fashion design.
Sure. I am originally from Lansing, East Lansing area, and I moved to New York and spent about 12 years there going to school and working in the fashion industry, basically working my way up from intern to design director for Simply Vera Wang. I moved back to Michigan when I was at the point in my career where I felt like I could do it anywhere, and that's when I started Michigan Fashion Proto, which is a sample making, pattern making, and short run production facility for the fashion industry. And about 2 years ago, I started with Molly Kircher Tribe. It's TRYBE.co. It's a contemporary women's clothing line that we sell coast to coast.
Mm-hmm. And now, would launching Tribe have been a whole lot easier with the Runway project? What do you make of what Jeff is putting together here?
Well, I think that the Runway is going to benefit people on every level. I know that as far as I go for Tribe, I will be utilizing several of the aspects or what they have to offer. But I think that people starting out who may not have the experience that I do are going to benefit the most. Someone who wants to start their own business will have a place that will hold their hand through the process and, you know, help mm-hmm. them start their, the legal aspects, the website aspects, and including helping with pattern making and sewing and, you know, just sort of pulling it all together.
Jeff, why Lansing, though? For listeners thinking
right.
of all
right.
the sectors to just kind of launch into, why Lansing for the fashion design sector?
Sure. I think the thought process started with some of the energy that's coming out of the Detroit area as well. There's a lot of great – and then also just in general, Michigan has a lot of rich design history. And I think there's a couple key manufacturers as well that maybe piqued the interest of the LADC in order to – push this forward, Peckham being one of them, being in the area. And I think also Rebecca's success and being able to see what she's been able to do put a certain level of validation behind the project that we can set this up. And I think in the end, you know, it has to start somewhere. And I know that people might scratch their head a little bit, but I think once they see the space and they see how it can function, it really will be something that will allow this industry to grow here in the state of Michigan as a whole. And I think it just goes back to our strong roots in manufacturing. We'd like to see this become a place where designers can come and get their brands produced.
So it really is a history of manufacturing and combined with design.
I think so.
It really triggers from the automobile industry, really, in a way.
Yeah, you're seeing a lot of manufacturing plant, or I don't know if you will call them plants, but shops basically down the Detroit area that used to do interiors for cars that are now doing denim lines and leather goods and things of that nature. You have the success of Shinola Watches, who has been getting a lot of press lately, and they took a manufacturing shop and retooled it to do high-end watchmaking. And assembly.
Rebecca, what was the biggest hurdle you faced in getting your career off the ground?
Well, making it in New York is the hardest part.
That must have given you some credential here, though, to come back to Michigan, and really, you had a credential that a lot of people didn't have.
Absolutely. Being here in Michigan is, in general, just a lot easier than trying to do something with success in New York. Starting your own label in New York is, nearly impossible. It's very, very difficult to make it in New York, launching your own line. Here, you have a lot less overhead, obviously. You have elbow room. You have less people pushing you out of the way. Basically. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is an amazing place to start a business of this kind.
We're talking with Lansing-based fashion designer Rebecca Clark, who has her own label called Tribe, and Jeff Henry. Jeff Henry, the operations manager for Lansing's fashion design incubator, about to launch in downtown Lansing. What was the genesis of the runway exactly, Jeff? When did this light bulb go on for you?
Well, I actually wasn't the one who came up with the idea. I was brought on later on to help bring this together. But the LADC, in partnership with LEAP, put money aside, non-taxpayer money aside a long time ago for a project in general. They decided a couple years ago to make it an incubator. They found the NAPS location, and that was going to be opening up. And then just based on some research and things of that nature, they came up with the idea to do fashion. Now, we have an incubator in East Lansing, the TIC, Technology Innovation Center, that focuses on tech startups already.
Right.
LEAP manages that. So they didn't want to do another tech startup. They thought, let's do something in a different industry. And this is what they came up with. And what it was is they tested it with the Michigan Garment Industry Council as far as would the interest be there. And the response was really enormous, and they knew that they were onto something.
Talk about the ideal location, though, too, because the NAPS building has this history as a retail outlet. You're going to go back into retail, and you're going to put retail back into that building.
Right.
And there was a lot of clothing that was sold at NAPS,
absolutely.
Needless to say, so it's really almost a night. The stars kind of aligned.
Right, and that's the great thing. It's not – if it was just a fashion incubator and – that'd be one thing. But bringing the retail aspect into it allows the public to come and interact with the runway and get a little sneak peek behind the curtain. I think the part of the success, and most people that maybe don't pay attention to the fashion industry as a whole, but know Project Runway, for example, the success with that show was that it gave people a taste of what happens in the background. And they found that people find that fascinating. And I think that's what the runway is going to be able to do is people will come off the street, they'll come to shop, and then they'll learn more about what's happening upstairs at the incubator, and it might inspire people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it will give people the power to you know, want to do something. And you mentioned, for example, some of the universities. That's super important. I mean, we have a ton, we have over a dozen universities here in the state of Michigan that have fashion programs. And I've gone and spoke with many of the student groups, and what ends up happening, I ask them, how many of you plan or would like to leave the state of Michigan when once you've graduated? And about 75% of them will raise their hands.
Yeah.
And that's great that they're ambitious like that, but the only reason that's partly happening is that there's not opportunity here, or they're not seeing the opportunities or the possible success that can take place. And we're just losing a ton of talent.
Sounds like you've got a lot of work to do between now and February,
though. Yeah, absolutely. This is an audacious project, but one that I think with setting the goals so lofty and having the ability to plan for the future, not only just this year but 5 years, 10 years down the road, how this can all materialize is what's going to make this successful. And having partners like Michigan Fashion Proto, which is Rebecca's manufacturing company, will be able to help make this, you know, truly successful.
You offering a lot of advice here, Rebecca?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I'm in it all the way.
Okay. Well, it's fascinating to learn more about this. We appreciate your visit here today to Current State. Jeff Henry is the operations manager for the new downtown Lansing fashion incubator, The Runway. Rebecca Clark has her own label called Tribe and is also involved in the endeavor. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Tens of millions of American adults have not graduated from high school. Every year, thousands of these non-graduates take General Educational Development Tests, the GED, to be considered proficient at the level of a graduate. Every 10 years, the GED test is updated to meet with current educational standards. Time is running out for individuals planning to earn their GED before the new test is put into place in January. The new test will be digital. It will focus on critical thinking skills and align closer with Common Core standards. Katie Stecker is in charge of the GED prep program at the Capital Area Literacy Coalition. Katie, thanks for joining us to break down all these changes.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Before we delve into the changes involved in the GED, give us a sense of who takes the GED. Who do you typically serve?
It varies, definitely. I mean, in Lansing, we have a lot of failing schools. There's problems with our educational system here. So a lot of people don't realize how many people actually don't finish high school in this area. As far as age goes, I would say sometimes older people get discouraged and think that it's too late for them, which is definitely never, ever true. But I'd say we have mostly younger people, but we definitely have older folks, too.
And what kind of impact does it have to actually get the GED certification?
Well, it used to be the case that people who did not graduate from high school could still start taking classes at LCC. That's no longer true. You do need to have a GED to start taking college classes. It also suggest to employers that a student has mastered the skills that would be expected of a high school graduate.
So you help people who want to take the GEDs to prepare for them. What's that process like for somebody to enroll in one of your GED classes?
Right. We have like a sort of three-step process. We ask new potential students to come in on Wednesday mornings at 10:30 to get screened. It's an open walk-in screening. We just test their reading level. It's like a 5-10-minute process. If a student's reading above an eighth-grade reading level, then they are eligible to participate in the program. If they're reading below an eighth-grade reading level, then we connect them with the basic reading services that we have in our organization. Now, we do this to ensure that a student will be successful with the GED material. A lot of programs will take anybody regardless of their reading level, and if someone's reading at about a third grade reading level, they're really not going to be successful with the GED material. Mm-hmm. After that, we have them come back to do a math test and a comprehension test, and then after that, every student will make an individual appointment with me. I learn about their needs, their goals, what they expect out of the program, and that's when we get them set up to be connected with a tutor. And they'll meet with their tutor one-on-one twice a week for an hour each until they're ready. They'll be taking practice tests, and they'll be studying on their own. There's a lot of things they can do.
And, I mean, your visit here is triggered by the fact that the GED is changing.
Definitely.
Come January. Talk to us about some of those changes.
Like you mentioned earlier, the most obvious difference is that it's no longer going to be on paper. It's all going to be on the computer. There's a lot of buzz about it being more difficult. I really try to avoid that kind of language. I think that has sort of a negative connotation. I think it's more challenging in that it's supposed to align itself with the Common Core standards that are the Common Core state standards that
right.
are being implemented in public schools. What's really happening is they've changed the framework of the test. It used to be something called Bloom's Taxonomy, and it was about like different levels of difficulty, and every question was worth 1 point, and they were all a similar difficulty level. Now they've shifted the framework to something called Webb's Depth of Knowledge, and this is less about difficulty per se and more about steps required, the sort of critical thinking required to complete a question. For example, if a question asks you to define the word big, that would be a depth of knowledge level 1 question. If a question asks you to define the word enormous, that would also be a level 1 question, even though the words are one word is more challenging than the other.
Okay.
They would just be one recall step.
Okay. What about costs here?
We're not sure what the new cost is going to be. Michigan is one of the highest GED costs, one of the highest states. Right now, it's $35 a test. There's 5 tests. It's $175. There's only going to be 4 tests. They're taking out the writing section, and they're integrating it into the other portions of the test.
Mm-hmm.
We do anticipate the cost will rise a little bit.
Do you know why Michigan is already relatively expensive?
I'm really not sure. It just seems to be that way, which is definitely a hardship for a lot of our students. You know, if someone doesn't have a GED, they have a hard time earning the kind of money that they'd like to be.
Okay. Are any of your students intimidated at the prospect of taking the new test? In other words, do you have have you had a spike in the number of students who want to get in before January?
Definitely. Fall has been crazy. We have had a lot of students coming in. No new students are actually eligible to take the current test anymore. So all of our new students are preparing for the 2014 GED.
Okay.
We've had a lot of people that want to get it in. Like I said earlier, I try to avoid that discourse of suggesting that the new test is more difficult because I don't want students to be like, oh, I don't want to do that. I want them to see it as an opportunity for hard work and to really enrich themselves, to really be a 21st century employee or college student.
We're talking with Katie Stecker, who's in charge of the GED prep program at the Capital Area Literacy Coalition. The GED changes in January. What happens to applicants who take the test and don't complete the test? Are they back at square one?
Unfortunately, that is the case. Like I said, there's 5 tests. A lot of students are just waiting on that math test. Math tends to be the most intimidating subject for a lot of our students. So they've completed all 4 tests except for that math test. They will lose all of those. They will forfeit those scores if they don't complete the battery.
How has your organization handled the transition to this new test? Has it been a lot of work for you guys?
Yeah, we're in transition right now. A lot of organizations are in transition. It's the publishers haven't really come out with their materials yet. It's been kind of crazy trying to figure out what to do. We're trying the best we can. In January, I'm going to have a meeting with all of the GED tutors and try to explain to them what's going on. But right now, it's kind of...
Well, so much happens over the course of a decade.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine what it's going to be like in another 10
right.
years, how to adapt to these things. What's your batting average in terms of preparing people successfully for the test?
Right. We administer the official practice tests, the official GED practice tests that come from the testing company. They're retired versions of GED tests. I don't send my students to go take the official test until they're scoring a 500 on the test. The minimum passing score is a 410. So I know when my students are scoring that 500, they're very, very likely to pass. So I think I've maybe had one student since I've been working for Calc that hasn't passed.
Will you literally be spending more time preparing candidates for the new test than you have the test you've been using?
That definitely depends on the student. People always want to know how long it's going to take to get their GED. That depends on their incoming level, how hard they're working, how flexible their schedule is. I feel like it'll probably be about the same. We are concerned about older students who are not as technology literate.
Yeah, I would think that there's a potential intimidation factor there.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Like I said earlier, we already have a problem with older folks thinking that it's too late for them, and we definitely want to express that that is not the case. We're currently working on getting some funding together to replace some of our computers in our GED library at our office. When we do that, we are planning to have a sort of tutorial, kind of basics computer class for GED students.
How is it the writing... How did the writing actually become incorporated into other parts of the test?
Well, they've decided that writing is such an important part of being a successful 21st century employee or a successful 21st century college student that it didn't make sense for them to just have one isolated portion of writing, because writing is so integrated into all academic fields. It's going to be on the reading section and the social studies section. In the past, a student was given a prompt and they were asked to use their personal experiences, thoughts, and feelings as sort of supporting evidence. Now students are going to be giving several pieces and be asked to write a synthesis essay, be used to, like, use the pieces to support their evidence.
Tell us a little bit more about what happens to those students who don't pass that initial reading test. What kinds of things do you prescribe?
You mean our diagnostic test?
The very first test to determine the reading level.
Yeah, we have several programs at Cal. The GED program is just a portion of what we do. We also offer ESL classes, English as a Second Language, mm-hmm. basic reading. We have some children's programs. Those students who are reading below an eighth grade reading level are connected to our basic reading services. It's the same thing. We'll pair them with a tutor. They'll meet twice a week. And then when they feel that they're ready or we know that they're improving, they're eligible to take the test again. We test our students every 40 hours of instruction to gauge improvement. So once they're reading at that eighth grade reading level, they will be able to start using GED material.
Talk to us just with your instructor's hat on here, though, just for 1 second. How do you feel about these changes as an instructor?
I get that question a lot, and although I'm worried that it is going to be a little more challenging for a lot of our students, I'm excited. I want the GED to mean something. If it doesn't get harder, if it doesn't align itself with what is expected of high school graduates, then what's the point, right? I want employers and colleges to see my students as smart and see them as successful. So I'm really excited that the GED is actually raising the bar.
And how do people reach the Capital Area Literacy Coalition?
Oh.
your website, I guess, is
yeah,
what I'm asking.
Yeah, we're www.thereadingpeople.org. I don't remember our phone number off the top of my head.
Well,
I'm so sorry.
You're part of the new digital generation there,
yeah,
Katie.
Yeah, but you can reach us there.
Thereadingpeople.org. Katie?
You can email us at mail.thereadingpeople.org.
Very good. The Reading People in Lansing. Katie Stecker's in charge of the GED Prep Program at the Capital Area Literacy Coalition. Katie, good luck. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Current state on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. WLNS-TV morning news anchor Evan Pinsenault is launching a new project, one that he hopes will bring local performers to television. The Evan Michael Show is a variety TV show in the mold of previous shows starring Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin and others. Now in production, the Evan Michael Show will air on WHTV My 18 starting early in 2014. Evan Pinsenault joins us now to tell us about the show and how he's fitting it into an already crazy early morning schedule. Your eyes are open over there, Evan.
No more gravy. I'm over gravy because of the week, and I'd be completely asleep right now.
Did you have a chance to catch up on your sleep over the Thanksgiving weekend?
I did.
Please say yes.
I did. Saturday was a sleep day.
Okay.
I forgot what I did, in fact. I think I went out to dinner with my girlfriend and her family. I just can't remember.
People see you doing the morning news on WLNS, and they've seen you in some local theater productions as well, but they may be surprised to hear about this locally produced variety TV show. Where did this idea come from?
Well, it's kind of the mix of two of my biggest passions and interests, one getting out there and being able to tell the good news stories, which I have the good fortune of doing right now through the Tell Me Something Good segment on the morning show.
Yeah.
And then I've got on the flip side, one of my degrees in school was musical theater, and I never really pursued it. I always just kind of did it as a hobby, and this community was just so warm and welcoming in terms of, hey, we've got great theaters, we've got great productions. You're a guy who's, you know, out in the community. Come out and audition. You know, we know you've got this passion buried down there. So I started doing that for fun, and then I met a gentleman by the name of Taylor Kelsaw, who a local TV producer, and he said, you know, I worked on the show In Her Shoes, and I worked on some other programs, and I love variety shows, Evan. You should be the guy who, with me, gets this going off
bringing
the ground.
It all together.
Yeah, and then we pow out for one day after a charity event, and we kind of just let the ideas percolate, and then a year went by, and we had an opportunity to put on a variety show for a United Way fundraiser, just as kind of like a let's see how it goes sort of a thing.
A prototype. Of, yeah.
And we just did it kind of just like the old Ed Sullivan, the old Merv Griffin show. We'd do it the golden age of television, or as I joke, the golden age of YouTube, because my father refuses to admit that I saw any of these shows. I said, Dad, that's what the internet's for. And so we put it on, and I did the big opening number, introduced the guests. The guests came out. They sang, they danced, they played their instruments. We all kind of talked and about their connection to the community and why the performing arts meant so much to them. We recorded it. We looked at it, and we said, wow, this could work.
So did you grow up watching shows? Are you patterning the show after a show that our listeners would be familiar with?
What we're trying to do, and without copycatting anything, but paying homage to what Taylor and I and what a lot of people think was the golden age of television. Back when you wanted to turn on the TV because of all the entertainers you would see, people you would recognize, people you would soon learn all about. And it was programming that you didn't have to worry about the content. You knew it was feel good. It wasn't going to be over the top. It wasn't going to be inappropriate. It wasn't going to be rated R. It was going to be fun family programming. And what we're trying to do is bring that back, but really do it in a modern day, more of an improvisational feel and localize it. Because that's the one thing that a lot of these shows that have tried before in the past, they've gone national, and they just haven't been able to connect with
they
the local
lost
audience.
Lost their focus.
Exactly. And we were very adamant about if we want this show to grow, the best way to do that is to really, you know, start it in a community that not only gets how important the performing arts are, but appreciates it and supports it. I mean, people don't realize that Mid-Michigan is a hub for the performing arts, for the cultural arts, for the theater arts. With all of our festivals, our music festivals, we have a world-class performing arts facility in the Wharton Center, and that's where we're taping the Evan Michaels Show. We have all these people from around the country and Canada who want to come here, who want to come to Mid-Michigan. Perhaps we haven't done a good enough job in the media of getting the word out about it, but now we can. Now we can because we've got this opportunity, 1 hour to bring on these guests, these talented people of all different ages and all different skill sets, and be like, hey, you're from the area or you come back to the area. What's it mean to you, and why do you like to perform? And boom, here's the stage in which you can do it, and here's your audience.
We're talking with WLNS-TV's Evan Pinsenalt. Where and when will the Evan Michaels Show be on our televisions?
We are going to launch in January. It will be on WHTV, My18, and the CW Networks. We're still waiting, once the new year gets here, to figure out the exact, slot that we'll fall into. But we're looking at a Saturday night debut night with a Wednesday replay. So Saturday night at 10 o'clock. We're hoping for January 18th, if all goes according to plan. And from there, we would like to do 13 episodes for season one, which is kind of what they call a full season.
Wow. Sounds like a lot of work and a lot of planning.
Yeah, it's more than I could have probably bargained for, but this is what I call good tired, Mark. This is the best tired to be, the type of tired where you're doing something you love and you're connecting with all these great people in the community.
Did WLNS consider it? They're apparently okay with you being on another station.
Yeah, well, you know, it turns out it's one of our sister stations with the way that they're expanding now with going into the other networks and going into other ways to really connect with the community. And they said, you know, Ev, just don't run yourself too thin. Don't let it conflict with the morning show. And three, you know, keep it good and positive the way you're doing it. And I said, well, nothing really conflicts with the morning show as long as I get a nap in there. And so that's why we're joking about doing the tapings in the afternoons or early evenings, so that way I can find, you know, that quick two-hour power nap in between to re-energize.
That's critical. Can people attend a taping? You're looking for audiences here?
Exactly. And that's the other beauty, the beautiful part about this, what I call really a very special ingredient to why we think the show will have a lot of success is the fact that we're going to do in front of a live-to-tape studio audience. It's free of charge every time we do a taping. You don't have to get tickets. You just show up. You sit in the audience. You banter back and forth with us during the commercial breaks. Sometimes we do segments where I go out into the audience and do a little singing and a little shtick with them or hand out some giveaways if we have some prizes through a partnership to hand out. But it's like imagine being at a great musical, but you actually get to interact with the people on stage, or watching a TV show at home, but you recognize and know the people who are on it, and it's the people you see. It's not like, wow, look at that guy. It's like, wait a second. You know, I just saw Ken Beachler the other day at the Wharton Center.
He fixed my refrigerator last Wednesday.
Who would have thought that guy plays the saxophone like that? And that's truly, we joke about it, but that's what we're hoping. We're hoping to really take all those people who we know and love and have seen before and put them on a stage where not only they can succeed, but other people can be proud to be from Mid-Michigan and proud to have gone to school here and worked here and performed here. And then we can get other people and other businesses and other communities to go, hey, we want to model our performing arts culture around the way Mid-Michigan does it. For one, all of their great shows, and then two, this new variety show.
How are you going to measure success here, though?
That's a great question. And, the first stick we have is the fact that we're getting to do this. I mean, for a long time, people said that you're not going to have the opportunity. This just won't work. You don't have the resources. How are you going to get the talent? You know, how are you going to have the time? And we overcame all those hurdles. So now, once we're on the air and up and running, for us, in terms of success, obviously, you know, there'll be ratings to look at. But as long as people are there, and as long as people are smiling and enjoying themselves and tuning in and going, wow, I feel good about the show and I feel good about the community, then for us, that's a win.
Evan Pinson-Ault is host of the upcoming Evan Michael Show, coming to WHTV My 18 starting in January. Good fun, Evan, and good luck.
Thank you, Mark.
The theme music, by the way, to the Evan Michael Show, which will be airing starting in January, according to plans. Its current state here on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Well, the Spartan football team is basking in the glow of an impressive regular season, 11-1, and the prospect of going to our first Rose Bowl since '88. Here to look back on Saturday and to look ahead at the conference championship game Saturday night against Ohio State, WKAR current sports host Al Martin.
How you doing, Mark? You know, when I heard you at the beginning of the show talk about that Alabama-Auburn game, I'm glad you're still alive after watching it, okay? Crazy, right?
You know, I'll tell you, for everything that happened to me over the weekend, it was a nice, rich, busy. It was like 1 hour it was really stimulating, and the next hour is really relaxing, which I think is kind of how it should go. I think that Auburn-Alabama game was in a way, the emotional focal point of the whole weekend. It was just amazing.
I died, came back to life after. I mean, it was one of the best college football endings you'll ever see in the game. Unbelievable, Mark.
Can you imagine?
Yeah. What a weekend.
Imagine the YouTube hits.
Have you seen the reaction videos?
Well, I saw some of them live. I haven't seen any of them played back.
Oh, they are hilarious! If you have not seen the reaction videos to that run back, you got to look on YouTube. There are hundreds of them, Mark. I lost my mind watching. My mom lost her mind watching it. Okay, she doesn't even like football.
Well, after Auburn pinned Alabama so deep in their own offense, in their own territory, what, the 1 yard line?
The 1 yard line.
One play later.
Yeah, one play later.
They go the length of the field, and then it all turns again.
Crazy game.
Really incredible. Well, Saturday, for Michigan State, Saturday wasn't as impressive a win as a lot of fans probably would have preferred, but a W is a W. Give us your takeaway of the Minnesota game.
Yes, I tell you what, well, you know, it was a business trip for the Spartans. The Spartans, they took care of business. I mean, Connor Cook looked very comfortable as usual. What really was surprising in that game, though, Mark, if you look at that Minnesota game, was that Minnesota actually, you know, had the ball. The time possession difference between Michigan and Minnesota was really a standout for that game. Minnesota had the ball most of the game in comparison to the Spartans, but they were still able to be efficient when they had the ball. Connor Cook, I thought he was great again. Jeremy Langford, I mean, how good has he been, especially looking at last season when you lose Le'Veon Bell, a power back. He was their offense last season. To see what Jeremy Langford has evolved into for this Spartan team, he's going to be very key, especially this week in Indianapolis against Ohio State.
How important is it to execute better on offense, though, this coming Saturday?
Oh, it's crucial. You know, you can't have any lapses going against Ohio State. And you know, it's something else, because when you look at this matchup between Ohio State and Michigan State, Ohio State has not played a defense as good as the Spartans. This is the number one defense in the nation statistically. OSU has not played, as good as they are on offense, OSU has not played a defense like the Spartans, and vice versa. This defense hasn't gone against a powerhouse offense, which is the best in the Big Ten in the Buckeyes. So it's going to be a clash, but you cannot, like you said, Mark, you cannot have mistakes, little mistakes, especially penalties, in this game this Saturday.
It's interesting, though, too, to consider what happened in Ann Arbor on Saturday, though, because even though our offense wasn't as dynamic as we would have liked, I mean, Ohio State had an even less impressive win in Ann Arbor. Our colleague Joe Rexroad wrote that neither Michigan State nor Ohio State are at full momentum.
Right.
Do you think they'll put all of that behind them come Saturday night?
Well, you have to. From perspective, going into the Big Ten championship game, you got to start off and have a mindset of a clean slate, Mark, no matter what. I mean, that momentum that you would like to have, you would like to have a little more momentum for both of these teams coming to this game. You would like to have that, but you got to start with a clean slate, and you got to just be efficient. Like I said, I go back to being efficient with the football. I mean, you got to do the little things right in this game, and I think that's going to come down to, Mark. But when you look at that game against OSU in Michigan, you got to be encouraged if you're a Spartan fan looking at how Michigan was able to score against Ohio State. Cook has got to be looking at that game saying, okay, because if you look at it, I think Michigan State's offense, as of right now, is better than Michigan's. And you look at the amount of points that they were able to put up against OSU, you got to be encouraged looking at that.
Well, Jeff Seidel of the Free Press wrote that University of Michigan has offered MSU a blueprint. Get it? Blueprint.
Yeah. I like this. Clever.
For how to beat Ohio State, namely throw the ball against a very suspect pass defense. Should we expect more throwing from Connor Cook or a lot of throwing?
He hit it right in the head. Yeah. That secondary for Ohio State is the biggest weakness for that defense. Connor Cook is going to have to get it to his receivers down the field. Benny Fowler, guys like Tony Lippett, Keith Mumphrey, those guys are going to have to come up with big catches. And again, looking at the play calling, I thought from a play calling perspective, Dave Warner has gotten, and Jim Bowman have gotten better as the season has gone on. Let it fly against this Ohio State defense, and I think they will be successful. And the receivers got to catch the football as well.
Everyone's hoping for an MSU win here, but just assuming the worst for just a second, where do you think MSU heads should we lose the Big Ten championship game in terms of a bowl game?
I tell you what, Mark, I think either way, Michigan State is going to be, you know, knock on wood, because you never know with the BCS, you never know with that computer, but I think either way, win or lose, Michigan State does go to Pasadena and play in that Rose Bowl. If they just stay in that top 14, if they stay in, win or lose this weekend, if they stay in that top 14, of course they will if they win. Even if they lose, they stay in that top 14, they automatically, I think, will go to the Rose Bowl.
Meanwhile, Ohio State's explosive offense goes up, as you said, against the nation's best defense. Blinding force meets immovable object. Is that right. Really the focal point of the game?
That is, without a doubt, because you talk about, this is, like you said, Mark, if there's been any consistent aspect to this Spartan team, it's been the defense, and it has been that way for years, these past few years. Michigan State's defense is the best in the nation. Ohio State's offense, is the best in the conference. Those two clash. That's the storyline. I don't see what other storyline it could be, Mark.
And we don't want to shortchange Michigan State's soccer team.
Yeah.
For the first time in many, many years, the men's soccer team has made it to quite an esteemed level in terms of the NCAA tournament.
Unbelievable. The Spartans now, you got to be feeling good if you're a Spartan fan. You got the number one basketball team in the nation. MSU is the football team is playing for the Big Ten Championship. The soccer team is going to the Elite Eight for the first time, Mark, since 1968 when they won a share of the NCAA title. I mean, that's a long, long time. They will play Notre Dame, actually, this Saturday at 7 p.m. Notre Dame beat Wake Forest 4-2.
It will be Notre Dame
this Saturday. Yep.
And how are you marking next Saturday?
Well,
what's your Saturday routine like?
I tell you what. Well, you know what, Mark? We are actually, Current Sports is hitting the road, and we're going down to Indy to cover that Big Ten championship game between MSU and OSU. I'm looking forward to it. I've never been to Indy. I've never been to Lucas Oil Stadium. It should be a fun time. So we'll have a lot of stuff on the web, a few stories on the web, and also Current Sports TV. We'll have some material for that next week, the following week after that game. So.
Excellent. Well, WKAR, Current Sports host on television and on radio, Al Martin. Thanks, Al. Have fun in Indy.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Today, by the way, marks the start of WKAR's 12 Days of Giving. Through December 13th, WKAR and its partners will serve as collection points for food and monetary donations that will go to the Greater Lansing Food Bank. You can find WKAR's donation bin in the main lobby here in the Communication Arts and Sciences building on MSU's campus. That's Wilson and Red Cedar, the intersection. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we welcome journalist Mickey Hurton, former executive editor of the Lansing State Journal, now transitioning to the Lansing City Pulse. Also, we discuss why some groups are concerned about the possibility of crude tar sands oil shipping on the Great Lakes. All that and more Tuesday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks also to producers Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl, as well as to Aaron Young for engineering and Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.